Hey, this is Michael Sedini from Eagle Imports and Walk the Talk America.
Hey guys, this is Julie Golub with Team Smith & Wesson, and you're listening to the Armed Citizen Podcast.
From the Ghost Tactical Productions Studio, welcome to the Armed Citizen Podcast. And now your host, Trey Miller.
I am your host, Trey Miller with Ghost Tactical Productions, and I have a really special edition of the Armed Citizen Podcast this week. And a buddy of mine, Mike Sedini, who we know is the founder of WTTA, we were down at the WTTA booth, and he says, hey man, you've got to come and listen to the story. This guy's got an amazing, incredible story that's both depressing, uplifting, and powerful, and all in the same sentence. And he says, you just got to listen to it. And he was talking to a woman from Mental Health America, and I was kind of just eavesdropping, listen to the story, and I was floored. I was floored by the message and what happens. And all this comes about with red flag laws. And as the gun community, we like to talk about the infringement on the Second Amendment with red flag laws. But sometimes we have to understand that there are people in our lives that are pro-gun, that are gun people, that may have times in their lives where they're not as mentally stable as they should for whatever reason. Obviously, we talk about veterans with PTSD, but that doesn't have to be the only mental health problem out there. We have a lot of things that could happen with accidents and all of that. And do we want the government to step in and confiscate our weapons and go through all the red tape to get them back through due process? Or is there a way that we might be able to combat this from the head? And so we're going to talk a little bit about red flag laws today. And we're also going to talk about or hear a story that will hopefully be inspiring and powerful, that you guys will love it as much as I do. But before we get going with the interviews, we want to talk real quickly about Sportsman's Guide. Guys, if you're interested in the outdoors at all, you've got to go check out sportsmansguide.com. They've got products for everything for you to pursue all of your outdoor passions, like fishing, camping, hiking, hunting, obviously firearms, ammunition, anything and everything that you guys could possibly want or need for your outdoors expeditions. Sportsman's Guide's got them. And if you really want to support us and our projects, then please head over to our website, ghosttacticalproductions.com. And on the upper banner there, you'll see corporate partners. Click on that and go shopping to Sportsman's Guides through our link on our website. Not only will you be getting some great deals, but you'll actually get us a piece of that pie as well, and you can help support the channel and help support all of our projects as well. My first guest is a good friend of ours. He's been on the podcast before, but he's a good friend of the channels and mine. It's Michael Sedini. He is the founder of Walk the Talk America. What's going on, Mike?
Oh, not much, man. Thanks for having me on tonight. I'm excited. This is a story that, you know, obviously you gave that little intro, but I'm excited for everyone to hear this because it blew me away when David and I got together and he was telling me. I mean, I've been with him from day one in terms of when things got crazy with the red flag laws and everything like that. So, you know, thank you. All right, thanks for doing this.
Yeah, and this is something that I think you saw, you know, when you first told me this is a powerful story, and I just listened to him for about 5 minutes or so, and I'm listening to this, I'm like, holy cow, this is not just for gun people, this is life, and this is much more than just the gun community, but it's a powerful story. And can you tell us how you guys met initially?
David, we met at the event in Colorado, right, the Denver Gun Days?
Yeah, Maj's event for Black Guns Matter. Yep.
Yeah, so we met down there, and I didn't know it at the time, but I was the speaker for mental health. They kind of walked me into that
there
one.
There you go.
But then we stayed in touch after just through social media, and then one day David hit me up, and he was like, hey, listen, I need I need your opinion on this one, because it was just such a difficult situation.
Yeah. And speaking of David, we've got our next guest. We're going to bring him in real quick. And he lives in Denver, Colorado. And his name is David Anastasi. So, David, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for coming on, brother. I appreciate you very much.
Yeah, man. I appreciate you having me and giving me the opportunity to talk about this.
Can you kind of take us through your stories of your life, how guns might have been prevalent in your life growing up?
I'm the first gun owner in my entire family. I started shooting. Buddy of mine back in Seattle, I grew up in Seattle, started just for fun, kind of going to the range and, you know, messing around, renting guns, stuff like that. And it kind of picked up. I went to school out in Boise, Idaho. So obviously, you know, a lot of my friends out there owned guns, went out shooting and stuff like that. So I got real interested in guns. Had always been interested in guns, but never owned one before. Bought my first gun when I was 23, got my concealed carry license, even though it wasn't required in the state of Arizona. But I've always been one of those people that believes that, you know, education is the best tool. So at every step of the way, I want to be the most educated person about, you know, certain things, especially when it comes to guns. You know, bought my first gun when I was 23 and have concealed carried every single day of my life pretty much when I can. And that's how it started.
So you didn't grow up a gun person or around guns, but then as you got older, you kind of adopted the gun lifestyle and become part of the culture, decided that I'm a big concealed carry guy, and that's one of the missions of my channel and my podcast. The name of the podcast is The Armed Citizen for obvious reasons, but you know, the whole idea of concealed carry is taking that responsibility to protect you, your family, and other innocent bystanders. And so it takes a special person to make that commitment. So now we know that red flag laws, and if you guys are out there listening and you don't know what a red flag law is, basically what a red flag law is someone can turn you into an authority, whether it's law enforcement or courts or whatever, and basically say that they don't think that you're mentally stable and you shouldn't be around firearms. And if it is proven that you are not stable or they deem you unstable, then they can literally come and confiscate your weapons. And they say you'll get them back, but there's no telling with the government red tape how long or if you'll ever get those guns back. That being said, in certain situations, I think those of us that are realists understand that there are points in times with loved ones in our lives where something's down, whether it's PTSD or they're in an accident or something has happened, that maybe having firearms around shouldn't be the best answer, but do we want to get the government involved? And I think that Walk the Talk America has done a wonderful job being on the front end of this. And Mike, do you want to talk about what WTTA stance is and what your stance is on the mental health side of firearms real quick?
Well, yeah, I mean, our stance is that there's a stigma that is placed on mental health, and mental health is a lot of people in the 2A community, and rightfully so, have always believed that mental health is a weapon used to take away the 2A rights. And that's why I work with Mental Health America, because they don't take that stance. They actually believe that mental health diagnosis does not exclude you from owning a firearms, you know, or concealed carry license or your firearm. So, you know, for me, our stance is we're still extremely pro 2A, but we believe that we could take a better stance on policing our own. So the programs and policies that we do, nothing has to do with legislation at all. Everything is straight up like us as a community coming forward and working with the mental health community and finding safe spaces. And I believe that we have to talk to the so-called other side, because if we don't, and we don't start policing our own, then that's where we're running into the situations where people do it for us. And, you know, if I'm not a gun person, like if I completely do not care about guns, as I do not care about, I don't know, women's shoes, I'm gonna not have that passion or understanding, right? So like, if they're gonna use that same concept on us when it comes to our firearms, because they're just not into firearms and they don't understand the culture. They don't understand that we're responsible, all those things. So, you know, that's what our stance is.
You know, I'm really glad to hear that you don't particularly care about women's shoes, because if you did, I'd have to worry about you, brother. Just saying. All right. So, David, knowing what we know now about red flag laws, your story is something that is very personal and is very powerful. And if you don't mind, could you kind of tell everybody your story and what happened and where you are now with it?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is all stemming around a slip and fall accident back in April of 2012. My dad and myself were in Las Vegas, and he slipped and fell outside of Planet Hollywood and hit his head, knocked himself out, and ended up with a traumatic brain injury. Stemming from that traumatic brain injury, he also did a little bit of damage to his hip. But specifically internally, he ended up with adrenal failure, pituitary gland damage. So with that, his body stopped producing hormones, or stopped producing the correct amount of hormones to, you know, keep his body balanced. All of the imbalance in hormones started causing what they call absent seizures. So it's not a physical convulsing seizure. It looks more like you're just drifting off into a daydream. You know, eyes are open, you don't blink, and you have to be physically startled to come back from this. So it got to the point where, you know, we had to pinch very hard, or, you know, do a chest rub on him to bring him back from having these absent seizures. And what happens is your brain is seizuring. So because of this, he was having so many of these absent seizures a day that he ended up being medically retired. And my dad, out of college, was essentially a business genius. My dad was the president CEO of the Global Chip Card Alliance in the 90s, who they came up with the chip cards that we use now on our credit cards and all this stuff. He was president CEO of a couple multi-million dollar technology companies. So my dad was very successful. And at the time where he had a slip and fall accident, he was in the middle of creating his own startup for data security. So this totally not only derailed our family's lives, but his life. And he was always one of those people, obviously, you know, high up in companies, that's used to being on a schedule. You know, he's in charge of a bunch of people. So it just, you know, hit him the hardest, because he goes from running these companies to being stuck at home, lost his license because of the seizures. He had a constant headache all the time. They had nerves melted in the back of his neck or in the back of his head. He had to have Botox shots done in his head to try and, you know, take that headache away. And over the course of, you know, 3 or 4 years, the doctors were trying to figure out exactly what was going on with his body, to figure out why he was having these seizures, and try and get his hormones stabilized. So he started to be put on a whole regimen of, you know, drugs and stuff like that to help his body produce hormones and replace, you know, testosterone and all these different things that his body wasn't naturally producing. So, you know, that takes a toll on your body as well. In the first 2 years, my dad actually almost died twice. We had to perform CPR on him because he stopped breathing, 2 different times. So that was a pretty surreal experience with that. Fast forwarding to 2018, his hip got so bad to where, the doctors suggested a hip replacement, but he had to lose 100 pounds for them to be able to do the surgery. He ended up losing about 100 pounds in 6 months. And in the last year to year and a half was when shit kind of started hitting the fan. Because my dad couldn't drive, he used to take the access bus, but then started taking Ubers everywhere. Met an Uber driver who I've met before, super nice guy. Drove my dad around all over the place. My dad would, you know, pay him to drive him around. But it got to the point where my dad started losing touch with reality, and he started becoming very irritable, started becoming very confrontational, short-tempered, started arguments over nothing. And this was totally out of character for my dad. Was always the type of person to try and resolve an issue over, you know, starting a confrontation over it. His Uber driver, he would drive him around to pretty much everything. Doctor's appointments, dinner, whatever he wanted to do, the guy was there for him, which was good, because my mom works. So it gave him somebody to hang out with. But it got to the point where my dad started spending insane amounts of money. He would go around just handing out cash. He would carry, you know, $10,000 in cash in his pocket at all times. Was going to the casino a lot, which wasn't necessarily out of character for him. He would go to the casino, but what started to be out of character was the amount of money that he was gambling. It was, you know, tens of thousands of dollars at a time. Prior to him getting his license back, in August, he bought a $130,000 Lexus, which isn't out of the normal for my dad. He always drove nice cars. But what was weird was he tried to buy a car for his Uber driver as well. $70,000 Lexus. And luckily, one of my friends who worked at the dealership, you know, kind of tipped me off about it. And my mom was able to talk to them about, you know, not going through with the sale. But again, this was in August before he got his license back. He bought these two vehicles. And then finally, he got his license back in September. He bought a motorcycle as well. And between the two cars and the motorcycle, I mean, you're looking at close to $300,000 just between those two. Not to mention the thousands of dollars in cash he would just go out and hand out to people. So,
and David, not to cut you off, but just to preface this for people at home, because I think there's a lot of people that don't understand, you know, every time they think of us like a loved one going off the proverbial reservation, right? They always think that you could do something to stop it. Like you could go to court or something and get some kind of order. If someone wants to take all their money and put it on black or buy Garfield posters or whatever, you know, whatever they want to do, they can do it. You can't kidnap someone. You can't force someone to do something when they're an adult. You can't. There's nothing you can do. But anyways, continue. Sorry.
He would get tired all the time. He, you know, his short-term memory was affected a little bit. But if you got him talking about something that he knew about, he could talk for hours. And he was still very normal. It was just, you know, certain things in his day-to-day life that were affected by the brain injury. And then in the past year, about May of 2018, was when it really started to spiral out of control.
Through this whole six-year ordeal, he had been dealing with a lot of physical problems that stem from a fall. It's something as simple as a fall. It's not that there was previous or prior problems. It was he was healthy 1 second and had issues the next second. And for 6 years, he's fought to get back to some sort of normalcy in life.
I have two younger brothers, and the three of us have always had an amazing relationship with both of my parents. So just starting to see like what was going on with my dad, we could obviously, the four of us could see the changes in him. And, you know, close family friends and people that have known him for a long time could tell that there was something going on. But to a person that would just meet him for the first time, he just seems like a very eccentric person. But being close to him, you could tell that something was going on. August was when I actually met Mike, like we said, at the Black Guns Matter event here in Denver. I met Edgar from Guns for Everyone and Mike and all these guys. And I sat in on Mike's talk about mental health because it was something obviously in the back of my head. My dad had previously mentioned maybe a month before that he wanted to look at getting a gun. And, you know, my mom's not into guns. She doesn't care that I own guns, but, you know, she doesn't want a gun in her house. So, you know, obviously with a traumatic brain injury, that was something that she absolutely didn't want, was my dad getting a gun. And at that point, you know, it was something that he started to talk about more and more because it was something that he could talk to me about that would be in common because I was into guns. So met Mike and sat in on that class, and it got me thinking about, you know, what if my dad keeps getting worse, or, you know, this kind of stuff. What if he ends up buying a gun? How would I feel about that? And the way his traumatic brain injury has affected him, and how his mood is changing, or his character's changing, or, you know, that kind of stuff is happening to him. And I could see it in a day to day change and hear it over the phone talking to him. So, I went home, to work at the venue that I started at, that for the company that moved me out here to Colorado. I went to work at that venue for about 10 days back in October, and stayed with my parents. My mom was at the time staying in the bedroom upstairs, and my dad was staying downstairs in their bedroom. And it was, you know, obviously kind of weird, but it was something that we knew was happening, and knew that with my dad's brain injury and the way he was going, that it was something that he had specifically asked my mom for. My mom didn't want it. My mom, you know, wants their relationship, and still to this day, even with all the stuff that has gone on, all my mom wants is for their, you know, my dad to come back, my dad to be the person he's always been. So we went down to Pike Place Market in downtown Seattle, and, you know, he's driving, he insisted on driving his brand new Lexus, you know, GSF, one of 200 made, you know, gorgeous car, and parks it in the handicap spot right in the middle of Pioneer Square, right next to where they throw the fish. And I'm like, this is where you want to leave, to park this car, like in downtown Seattle. You want to leave this car like right here, right in the middle of everything. So we get out of the car, he parks it there. He sees this guy, a homeless guy, playing the guitar right there next to the fish market, and pulls out an envelope, probably $7,000 to $10,000. And I almost lost my mind. I was like, we're in downtown Seattle right now, and you're going to openly pull out an envelope with hundreds, you know, thousands of dollars in cash in the middle of downtown Seattle at the marketplace, where anybody that wants that cash could just run up behind you, knock you out, take it, and not be able to do anything about it. So gives this guy like $300 or $400, you know, just playing the guitar, sitting there, you know, which is cool. My dad's always been a very philanthropic person, but like I said before, it's always been done the right way. He always, you know, Ronald McDonald House, you know, that kind of stuff, he's always given money to. That whole experience happened. Actually, right after that, there were a couple guys that were looking at my dad's car as we were coming back up to it. And my dad handed one of the guys the keys to the car and was like, "Hey man, I want you to start it up. I want you to get in it, rev the engine." And I was just like standing there, like, you have no idea who this person is, and you just handed them the keys to a $130,000 car. All they have to do is close the door and drive away. You know, trying to keep my cool during this whole situation was testing my limits for sure. And this started becoming like a day-to-day occurrence with my dad. Giving the money away, doing stuff like this was a day-to-day occurrence that started happening more and more. You know, that same week that I was home, him and my mom got into a big argument, and, you know, being there to hear the way that my dad talked to my mom while they were having this argument was just, it was beside me that the way he was talking to her. And so me and him got into it, and he essentially tried to kick us out of the house, that night that we got into the argument. And my mom was already kind of planning, like looking for another place to live, because my dad was saying that he wanted her to move out. The end of every argument was, "I want you out of the house. I want you out of the house." And so finally, you know, it was the opportunity with me being there that, you know, the person that she was talking to had the house that she could get the keys to, and I helped her move out of the house that week that I was home. It was the next day or the day after, whatever it was, while I was home, my dad asked me to go with him to buy a gun. And I told him, I was like, you know, I think you should hold off on that. You know, maybe see, get your, you know, once you recover from your hip surgery, make sure, you know, get your stuff back on track, get your meds in control, go see your doctors and, you know, let's talk about it after that. And, you know, he got kind of upset about it because, you know, I'm the gun guy and I'm the one telling him that he should wait. 2 days later, I come home from work and he's got a shotgun and a rifle in his living room. And he's like, oh man, come check these out. You know, shotgun, rifle, sitting on the coffee table. I was like, oh, cool. So that's kind of where it started. As far as where the gun purchases go.
And this is October of 2018, correct?
Correct. Yeah. So I was home October 17th through the 27th. And that's when he bought his first two guns.
And at this point too, he's drinking. So
yeah. And it's not excessive. He's having a couple beers here and there, but, you know, it's nothing out of the normal for what my dad used to have for drinks. It was, you know, a beer here and there. We had drinks, whatever. He asked me one of the days before I left to go down to Dick's Sporting Goods, and he had bought a safe. And we tried to put it in the back of his SUV. I told him it wouldn't fit and he was going to mess up the roof of the SUV or the back door of the SUV trying to get it in there. And we got in an argument in front of, you know, the employees from Dick's Sporting Goods about whether or not the safe would fit. And it got to the point where he told me to walk away and had them shove the safe into the back of the SUV. And, you know, this is like a 600-700 pound safe. It's like a 20 gun safe. So it's a huge safe. And we had to tie the door down and we drove it, you know, there's hills in Seattle. So I'm telling him, I was like, you need to take this slow, you know, don't gun the gas. And of course, going up the first hill, he hits the gas too hard and the safe slides 4 inches. And I was like, I almost lost it. Luckily, the safe did not fall out. And my anxiety was just through the roof, just trying to hold, turned around from the front seat, trying to hold this 700-pound safe in the car, like I was going to stop it from sliding out the back. But it was just so luckily it did not slide out and it did not blow a hole through the window, through the back window. And we got it back home. So he got a safe, which, you know, obviously he's buying guns, you know, told him to buy a safe. Cool. Awesome. You know, being safe about it. Over the next month after I left, bought 14 more guns. All in all, in a month, spent about $55,000 on guns, ammo, and accessories.
So he wasn't just buying cheap guns either. He was going for the... He was going to fill that safe up with some top-notch shit.
Yeah, STI 2011s, SCAR, you know, Benelli shotgun.
God, all right. Dude, I mean, if you're going to go big, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's how my dad was. You know, if he's going to buy something, he's always going to have the top of the line. But, you know, $55,000 worth of guns in a month and you know, sights, ammo, and he has never owned a gun in his life, ever. He shot a gun that I know one time when he went to Sturgis, and it was a friend's gun that, you know, they went and shot once, as far as I know. So obviously, you know, he tells me that he bought all these guns, and I'm like, holy shit. Like, you know, I'm a little jealous because, yeah, I wish I could buy that.
Right? I mean, just a little bit, right?
Like, all right. So,
you know, I can go shoot some cool guns when I get home, but, you know, being, as I said, never owned a gun in his life to owning $55,000 worth of guns and ammo and all this stuff is obviously something that is concerning to me, a red flag, you know, no pun intended. One of the other days we went down to Clearwater Casino. I went with him to, you know, we spent the night there, went, did some gambling, hung out, grabbed drinks, whatever. You know, father son type stuff. And while we were sitting at the table, we were in the non-smoking section, so had a couple tables in there. There weren't many people in there, and my dad was betting $2,000 a hand, and he was playing three hands at a time, and he gave me money to play two hands. So we were taking all five spots at the there five out of six spots at the table. My dad got tired, you know, went up to take a nap, came back down probably like 30 minutes later. And my dad wanted to reserve the table so that we could go grab something to eat. And they told him that they would hold two of the spots, but he couldn't reserve the table. The dealer that was dealing our hands started just taking his money, just killing him. And he was getting upset. And he asked the table supervisor if they could change the dealer. And obviously they're on a schedule. They just can't change the dealer because they change tables and, you know, they're on a schedule. So she told him that, and my dad got pissed and started arguing with her. You know, I spend this much money here. I should be able to do whatever I want. You know, call your manager, the stuff that my dad never did. That started to become a normal thing where, you know, somebody would say something to him or disagree with him on anything, and he would just go at it and not stop until the other person was just like, fine, whatever. And over the next, you know, month to 3 months, it just, the stories just start getting crazier and crazier. So my dad had also started smoking weed again. He used to go to the Bob Marley birthday festival in Jamaica every year with friends for a guy's trip. And, you know, it was one of those things like, you know, don't ask, don't tell. The other thing with the weed was it would help him with his headache. So, which was a good thing for his brain injury. So, you know, that obviously the medicinal side of that was the main reason that he started smoking again. There was one conversation that I had with him over the phone where he was at the pot shop and they were closing. The guy was literally locking the door as he pulled up. So the guy's locking up the shop and my dad walks up to him. You know, obviously this dude, you know, just pulls into the parking lot, walks up to the guy. He's like, hey man, you know, can you just open the shop back up? I just want to get a couple things. And the guy's like, no, I can't, you know, we're closed for the night. You can come back tomorrow. And my dad was like, oh, you know, I really just want to grab something. What, you know, I got 20 guns in my trunk. What, you know, how do I convince you? And I was just like, what? Like, you did, how do you say that to somebody in public? Like, just pull up to the dude at the pot shop and tell him you have 20 guns in the trunk. He started telling stories about, you know, buying the Dallas Cowboys, buying the Boston Red Sox, all this, you know, all these things that obviously aren't true, were stories that he started telling. So he started to become very paranoid, and he started calling the cops about people watching his house or people following him or people being in his backyard. So the Renton Police Department became very familiar with my dad. One of the last stories that was kind of the last straw for us as a family before we knew that we had to do something to help him was he told my brother that he had fallen asleep a couple times and almost crashed his car. So obviously that had become a thing because he was so, you know, he was depriving himself of sleep. He was drinking a lot of energy drinks. He was partying and he was overly tired. So he hit a curb and blew out his tire, drove his car home, I don't know how many miles, but on the rim of the front driver's side tire is the one that he blew out. And the story that he told about why that happened was the casino elders were sending somebody to kill him. Somebody had pointed a gun at his face and shot out his tire, and he got away from them. And that's why he drove home on his rim, on his wheel, with no rubber on it. And so at that point, it was and that was it for me. And I had been talking to Mike about this for, you know, since I met him. I kind of started talking to him about him, telling him about the events that were going on, and asked him for advice, you know, what we should do. And after I told him that story, he talked to one of his friends and mentioned the extreme risk protection order, which is the red flag laws. And at that point, owning 16 guns, having 16 guns in his house, it got to the point where, you know, all I could think about was he's overly paranoid. He's obviously calling the cops because he thinks people are watching him. People are trying to kill him. And he lives in a neighborhood with a bunch of kids. You know, what's to stop him from, you know, what, somebody knocking on his door or somebody being in his yard or whatever, and him freaking out and shooting them. It was, for me, obviously it wasn't him going to harm himself. It was more, you know, what could happen if he gets to the point where he's so paranoid that he doesn't recognize somebody that comes to his door and thinks that they're there after him and shoots them. So my brothers and I talked about it, and, you know, I told them about the red flag laws, and my mom was on obviously part of the conversation as well. And we decided that it was something we were going to, my brothers and I were going to fly to Seattle and talk with my dad and try to get him to go see his doctors, to go see his neuropsychologist, to get a blood drawn, get his blood panel done to make sure he was taking the right meds, get him off the meds that he needed to be taken off of. So it was November 13th was when we flew to Seattle. My middle brother talked to the Renton Police Department a couple days before this to let them know what we were going to do. Obviously, because we knew about the red flag laws, we wanted to have the option of having the police come in and help us if we needed it. But obviously our initial, what we wanted to try initially was to get him to go see his doctors voluntarily to get him help.
So can I ask you real quick though?
Yes.
You had the plan of trying to get him help, but in the back of your mind, there was the thought process of, if it doesn't work, we might have to take his guns. You contact the law enforcement. How did they respond? Were they, you know, were they helpful, or were they, you know, because a lot of people will sit there and say the law enforcement's out to get, if there's red flag, they're going to confiscate the guns. Did they seem eager to confiscate, or were they helpful to you, or how did that play out?
They were amazing, to be honest with you. They were very helpful. They were very understanding. My brother told them, you know, the same story, you know, essentially that I just told. And obviously they want people to be safe. You know, they don't want somebody to get hurt. So, you know, they told us anything that we need to give them a call. They gave us an officer's number who we could call that day that was going to be on duty if we needed help. And so that's how it worked out. But we got to Seattle November 13th and decided that we were going to go, you know, to his house on November 14th. My brother called him to make sure he was home, you know, and so we went and knocked on the door and kind of surprised him. And my brothers and I sat down with my dad and told him, look, you know, we're concerned about you. We see these changes. It's not in your character, all this stuff that you're doing, the amount of money you're spending. And we want you to, we know you're skipping your doctor's appointments. We want you to go in and see your neuropsychologist, get your blood work done. And it was a no. It was a hard no. And so we tried for probably 3 hours. We sat there, had conversations, you know, it got emotional. Towards the end of the 3 hours, my dad got to the point where he was just done with it. And he kept on asking me if I wanted to go shoot his guns, if I wanted to go to the shooting range with him. And I was like, no, this, you know, this isn't what we're here for. We want you to go see your doctors. When we walked in the house initially, obviously I knew he had the gun safe. None of the guns, nothing were in the safe. The safe was open, it was unlocked, and there was nothing in it. All of the guns were in range bags in his living room. Ammo is still in boxes. Nothing was loaded, but they were all sitting in range bags. One of the rifles was sitting out of a bag. And, you know, over the last month, there were so many random people that were coming and going in my dad's house that anybody could have stolen a gun. Anybody could have, you know, whatever. And they're just sitting out in the open. And so he got to the point where he was so adamant about, you know, he had an appointment to go down to the range to have somebody give him shooting lessons, that he grabbed the rifle, grabbed the bolt action rifle, and was ready to walk out the front door with it out of a range bag into a neighborhood where there's a bunch of kids, you know. So I'm obviously, my mindset changes there. There's no way that I'm letting him out of the house with a gun, you know, whether it's loaded or unloaded. It's a bad idea, especially the mindset that he's in. He's agitated. He's upset. He's now telling us that we're trespassing in his house. We're trying to kidnap him, this and that. And so at that point, it started to get a little bit physical. My brothers and I were blocking him from going outside with the gun, and he started pushing and shoving. He eventually set the gun down, so we got it away from him, but he was so adamant about going outside. We knew he had his keys in his pocket, and he wanted to leave. We knew he wanted to leave. So it starts getting more physical. He ended up choking my brother, punched my other brother. And so it got to the point where I was just done. I told my brother that had been in contact with the police to go outside and call the officers, that this was it. You know, this was the line. We needed help. We need them to come in and help us bring him in. You know, we're not leaving his house without him going to get help, whether it's voluntarily or involuntarily. He needs to get help. So as soon as my brother goes outside to call the police, my dad sits down and finds out what my brother's doing, calls 911 himself, tells the dispatcher that we're there kidnapping him, holding him hostage, trespassing in his house. My oldest son, me, has guns. There are guns in the house. And I'm just like, holy shit, you're telling the dispatcher that we're holding you hostage. There's guns in the house. They're going to send SWAT. So yeah, I'm trying SWAT to
come in, and probably the FBI.
So yeah. I'm trying to talk over him so the dispatcher hears me, to let the dispatcher know that, yes, there are guns in the house. None of them are loaded. Nobody has any firearms on them. Nobody has any weapons on them. You know, luckily, my brother was talking with the officers for the dispatcher who, you know, worked for that police department. So she knew what was going on and kept my dad on the phone, you know, calm my dad down. My dad talked to her for probably 45 minutes. So, which was amazing.
That's a dispatcher right there.
Oh, it literally what saved the moment, what calmed him down, was being able to talk to somebody that wasn't us. So all these cars, you know, the trucks are in the neighborhood.
And so now it's a thing. I mean, it's a thing at this point.
It's a huge thing at this point. So my dad, the two officers come in, A couple SWAT guys come in, and my dad knows what's going on immediately. And so these guys, one of the sergeants, one of the SWAT guys, sat and talked with my dad, tried to convince him to go in voluntarily, to come with us, to go see his doctors. You know, we were here to help him. We're not here to, you know, kidnap him. We're not trespassing, this and that. Spent probably another hour trying to talk my dad into going in voluntarily. And it got to the point where it was actually the paramedics walked up to the front door, because the front door was open because a couple of the officers were standing there. And my dad saw the paramedics. And as soon as he saw the paramedics, he knew that it was, there was no choice. You know, he was either going in, or, you know, voluntarily, or he was going in strapped to a gurney. So he lost it. He tried to go out the back door. You know, we kind of, me and my brother kind of held him. He was pushing and shoving, and, you know, we kind of got him calmed down a little bit, where they brought the stretcher in, and it was still trying to get him to go in, you know, without the physical altercation, without having to strap him down and all this stuff, but he wouldn't cooperate. He was fighting us the whole way. They helped us get my dad onto the stretcher. They had to strap him down because he was struggling, and, you know, wheeled him out to the front yard, and he's screaming at the top of his lungs, you know, they're kidnapping me, this and that, they're, you know, trespassing, they're taking me hostage. I don't condone this. This is against my rights, and just causing as much disturbance as he can. So, but, you know, finally got him in and into the ambulance, and they took him off. So after that, the officers that were there, they had a crime scene investigator who, when you red flag somebody, because at this point, now that they took him involuntarily, it was he was involuntarily committed by the Renton Police Department. So what that means in the state of Washington is it is an automatic 72-hour hold. You're involuntarily committed, 72-hour hold. Because he had the guns, they red flagged him. The Renton Police Department red flagged him by request of us, obviously, because of the things that I saw and I heard him say. I was the one that made the choice to have them red flag him.
At this point in the state of Washington, once you have been red flagged, can you just briefly go in and tell people that aren't familiar with the actual, what a red flag, how it works, how long, or what's the process? Do they confiscate the guns? And if so, how long do they keep them?
So at this point, when we decided to red flag him, the crime scene investigator would normally go in and, you know, obviously take the serial numbers, that kind of stuff, inventory it, and guns, ammo, whatever, they take possession of it. So, you know, me being a gun owner, me still having the question of red flag laws, you know, what is going to happen with it? It's $55,000 worth of guns and ammo and all that stuff. I asked them what the other options are. So the other option is they transfer possession of all of it to a family member, which the crime scene investigator there fills out the paperwork. The family member who is taking possession of all of the stuff, the firearms, the ammo, all of it has to be taken out of the house. The person they're transferring possession to is now responsible for all of it. So they transferred possession to me. I signed the document.
So was a document that you signed, did you have to go and fill out 4473s to transfer those, or is this another legal document that they had?
It was a legal document that they had. So you do not have to do a transfer, an ownership transfer, because it is them transferring. It is the police department transferring the guns to the family member that is taking possession.
Okay.
So,
and I think it's interesting because the conspiracy theorists and the tinfoil hat guys in the gun community seem to always say, you know, if they come for your guns, you're never going to get them back. And it seems to me from the outside looking in that not only were they helpful, they gave you an opportunity and an alternative to confiscating the guns. So not all law enforcement and not all government agencies are out to come get your guns. So I think it's refreshing to know that not only did they help you throughout this entire process, but they gave you an alternative to going down the path of confiscation, which I think is phenomenal.
Exactly. And that was my biggest concern is, you know, what if they take possession of them, what's the process to get them back? So because the Renton Police Department was the ones that red flagged him on our request, we could have done it as a family. The Renton Police Department went to the hearing, you know, due process, went to the hearing with our consent and went in front of the judge and, you know, told the judge what was going on, what the situation was. And the judge was the one that decided how long my dad was not able to be in possession of a firearm. So they decided 12 months. So after that 12 months, it just, you know, the red flag, the extreme risk protection order just expires. So there's no.
So did you, so after a year, assuming that he's deemed stable and ready to go and the court and the doctors deem that he's ready to, you know, repossess his firearms, do you have to go back and then sign another transferring it back, or is it automatically done?
It's automatically done. I can just give him back his guns. So that was my thing, you know, my questioning the red flag laws thing was obviously I didn't want them to just go sit in, you know, the, you know, evidence locker, wherever the hell they were going to store them.
Things seem to disappear somehow.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, that's, you know, when it comes to government, when it comes to that kind of stuff, obviously that's where I start to question it. Where is it going to be in 12 months? You know, so my best option for us was that I took possession of it because I didn't want to have to deal with that 12 months later. The other thing as well is because of how my dad's brain injury was affecting him, I didn't know where he was going to be mentally in 12 months. So I wanted to be the one that when it expires, if they haven't, you know, deemed him mentally fit to care for himself, I didn't know what after that was the process of, you know, if they kept them longer, what would happen is if they don't deem him mentally fit to care for himself, there would be another trial and they would decide, you know, how much longer he would be without guns, you know, not be able to possess guns.
Now, I'm assuming at these hearings, you have the judges presiding over this, but you have the law enforcement, the sheriff, whoever it's there in the law enforcement. But I'm assuming they also will have doctors of some sort, it's a psychologist, medical doctors. They're not just, a judge is not just sitting up there saying, well, I don't think he's ready to go, so I don't deem him. I'm assuming that he's taking information from all sorts of people to make a conscious and an educated decision, correct?
Yeah, so it was because he was involuntarily committed, obviously he was, and he's on a he was on a mandatory 3-day hold. They deem him unfit to care for himself at that point. So that's how they made the decision, was because he was deemed mentally unfit to care for himself, that's how they came about the decision of 12 months. He started skipping doctor's appointments, went to one appointment with his psychologist, and then just started skipping them. They released him December 3rd was when he got out of the hospital. And then that's like, it just continued. You know, he obviously knew that he couldn't buy more guns. You know, with the red flag law, he would be denied a background check on the background check. So he was obviously pissed off that we took his guns, but he started buying sports memorabilia. And we always go home for Christmas, my brothers and I, for family Christmas, and buy between December 3rd and Christmas Eve, my dad had spent over $400,000 on sports memorabilia.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is the thing that people, when they think of red flag laws or they think of people going off the said reservation, they don't, they always apply their own experience to things. They always look at themselves as, well, I'm a law abiding citizen, and they worry about a red flag law being placed on them as a person who has no mental issues and is just a pure 2A responsible adult. So this scenario is absolutely something that, you know, you have to step outside of what you see it as, the threat to you. You have to look at it as, you have to almost do what that Matthew McConaughey did in A Time to Kill. You have to close your eyes and visualize it with your wife or your father, somebody that you love so much, right? Like, that's how you have to look at this situation. You can't look at it as like, you know, hey, my lover that scorned, you know, red flag me. Like, and that's an important distinction I think people have to make when they hear this story.
At this point now, since he bought the cars in August, he's spent over $1 million. And he,
holy cow,
specifically, like, some of the stuff that he's bought, sports memorabilia, 2 sets of official Dallas Cowboys Super Bowl rings, 10 rings. So, you know, they've won 5 Super Bowls. He owns 10 Super Bowl rings. You know, Michael Jordan signed memorabilia. He bought the torch that Muhammad Ali carried to light the Olympic torch
in Atlanta.
Yes.
Holy cow.
Yeah, signed by Muhammad Ali.
Wow.
Yeah. So, I mean, my mom has gone through the credit card statements, and it's like $15,000 here, $25,000 here, like just going for it. And, you know, in his mind, he's starting a collection. He's going to have the best sports memorabilia collection there is, and he wants to start a museum. And it's just like, what are you doing? And it's just stuff that it makes sense to him, but it doesn't make sense to anybody else.
I mean, I don't mean to laugh, and I apologize for laughing, but
no,
I've never heard of anything like this, and it's almost like this can't be real. And for most people, this would never be reality. The crazy thing is not only is this reality for you, this happened within a 6-month period.
Yeah,
it's a dark Forrest Gump. I mean, it really is.
It's amazing to me. Like I said, I mean, you know, and I'm sorry for laughing, but it's crazy to me to fathom.
What other reaction can you have?
Yeah, like, I mean, it's crazy, and it's hard for me to fathom.
When we there was a moment that David and I had, because he was texting me updates while his dad's down in Jamaica, and at one point I was scrolling our conversations and what he's sending me. And I said to my wife, I go, if you read this, you would almost think David and I were crazy because it reads like a crazy blog, right? Like just one crazy story after another. It absolutely would be a fascinating movie at some point.
Oh yeah. That's what we're going to say is you're scrolling through this, if someone should get your phones and read this, they're thinking, these guys are screenwriters and they're writing the next, you know, Hangover movie or something. I mean, this is something that's straight out of Hollywood. And unfortunately, this is real. This is real shit.
That's exactly the movie that I said to when Mike said that. I was like, this is like Hangover 4. But so So there's still more to this story, by the way.
Oh, great. Can't wait. Holy shit.
It just goes on. So my dad was walking around Jamaica with a signed BB King guitar. And
what?
Yes. A signed BB King guitar.
Wow.
He brought to Jamaica with him. And there's a picture of my dad on a motorcycle in Jamaica, and he's wearing 3 Dallas Cowboys Super Bowl rings.
This is surreal to me. It's unbelievable that this is actually reality. And that's what the difference is for us, that seems so odd, but I'm assuming to him, it's normal.
Normal. So my dad had brought 5 of the Super Bowl rings with him to Jamaica and ended up trading them for drugs, all 5 of them.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
And I don't want to stray too far from the story because I'm sure you probably still have some more. And I want to get to that here in a second, but I want to kind of touch on real quick the mindset, bringing it back to the 2A and the red flag laws. Is if anyone out there that is pro-gun, that is ever in this situation, I want to pose a question to you. What would you do in this situation? Are you telling me under no circumstances will anyone ever take my guns and deem me incapable of having guns or firearms? And something like this happens. Once again, we're not talking about a person who has a life history of mental illness. We're talking about an accident that happens and in a second is a changed person. I question and I challenge anyone who's pro-gun, that is a shall not be infringed for my cold dead hands, will not comply, to be put in the same situation and ask yourself, if that was my father, that was my brother, that was my mom, my daughter, my son, what would you do? And if you come up with any other answer besides we've got to get the guns away from them, then I question your sanity. So I just wanted to, you know, because there's a lot of people out there that are so non-compliant that they can't put something like this into perspective. This is not a rhetorical question. This is not a rhetorical event that what if this happens? This is happening to you. And I would tend to believe that your outlook on being able to take someone's guns because you're fearful of harming themselves and other people is completely different than it was 3, 4, 5, 6 years ago.
Yeah, that was when it came down to it. That was, you know, and it's something that Mike and I talked about. That what am I going to do? Where is my moral compass? Am I going to, in my mind, I see my dad going down this path and knowing what he has said and what he is doing and how he is acting, am I going to be okay with letting him keep his guns and hurting someone, or him being hurt and knowing that I could have prevented that? Is that something that I want to live with? And it you know, I'm a decent human being. I always tell people that I'm the nicest asshole you'll ever meet. But, right.
But I understand. I resemble that.
Yeah. But I would never be able to live with myself if I knew that I could have prevented it.
And this is because David wrote, he submitted the story on walktotalkamerica.com or .org, WTTA.org. You can get it to him all 3 ways. But he submitted the story. And of course, you know, when you write out the story, this is a long story and it takes a long time to build this up. So he told this story and it involved a red flag law and his father. Well, it was funny because it automatically goes up onto Facebook, and there is a guy on Facebook. And if you go to where that story is, we kind of engaged in this conversation because he had this attitude of, well, if Walk the Talk America is even going to entertain talking about red flag laws, don't let the door hit you in the ass. And that was, you know, it's one of those things where I was like, okay, let's try to pick his brain here. And I said, did you ever have a story that's similar to David's? And, you know, he tells a story about how he successfully stopped his friends by having an intervention. And he says that we told him and he understood. And then he went voluntarily and had this great happy ending. And immediately I'm going, that's awesome. Like, that's awesome that you guys rallied around your friend. And I said, do me a favor. One last question. I'll let you go. I said, same scenario with your friend. This time he punches you in the face, strangles your friend, and brandishes a firearm. What do you do? And we waited, and it was crickets. Because
you're
no one
kidding.
Wants to answer
you're
that
question. Kidding.
it's like we knew it. And then, and, you know, because David and I were talking about it, I said, I want to ask him this question. I want him to frame it up for me. I don't think it's an easy answer. And obviously people are so scared now to give their opinion because they don't want to be kicked out of the 2A kingdom. You know, because heaven forbid you say something that, you know, yeah, I would have called the police and had this whole scenario go down. But you got to ask yourself, and I think everybody listening at home, if you have the solution, please say it. You know what I mean? But
right.
I don't think it's an easy one. So
let us know, because especially go to WTTA and tell your story, because the more information that as a society, not just a gun community, but as a society that we can get, that's just going to help the next person who might have to go through the same struggle. So if you've got a story, you know, please go to WTTA.org. And if you're willing to tell that story, that could help the next person. And I'm interested to, you know, to hear, and David, I want to say, we're going to keep in touch because I want to continuously hear how you're doing and how your family's doing, how your dad's doing. But more importantly, I would like to hear what's going to happen next November, when obviously you have possession of these firearms. And not that the firearms are the big story of this. It's not. It's a very, very minute side of the story. But for the gun community, this would be an interesting kind of experiment to see in November, when you basically have the power to do what you want to with these firearms, is it going to be something that he is going to get them back because he has proven to you and the court and the doctors that he's fine? Or is this going to be something that lingers on much, much, much longer? And so if you're willing and able to, I would love to obviously get you on any time you want, but especially maybe in November.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Mike, I want to bring you back in real quick I want you to talk to people about, once again, WTTA, what you guys are offering, what you guys can help people with on your website, and obviously WTTA.org, walkthetalkamerica.org, but also maybe tell people where on social media they can find you guys as well.
On all the social medias, it's under Walk the Talk US. You know, our Instagram page is full of stuff. We constantly put stuff up there just to get people to think, to get people to discuss things, and also to announce some of the things we're doing. You know, one of the things I'm excited for is basically this insert that we're going to be putting in all Eagle Imports firearms, which is any Bursa, Metro Arms, Llama, American Classic, Mac, and SPS firearms, and Avidity Arms when that finally gets done. But we're going to put a card in there that just, it's basically like the wristbands that everybody wears in the community. There you go.
How about that WTTA right there? There you go.
Yep.
I know you go. David's got yep. one. We're all sporting them, man. There's a lot of people supporting you, Mike. I know you know that. And I hope you feel that. But there's a lot of people that support what you're doing, and I want to congratulate you on what you're doing as well before, you know, we move on any further. I know you want to talk about what you guys are doing, but I wanted to say personally that thank you for doing what you do.
No, man, and thank you guys for the support, and I'm glad there's a bunch of us that get it, you know, because mental health isn't going anywhere. This isn't a fad. This isn't like the Taliban or the ISIS or, you know, that eventually one day we're going to be like, remember that? It's only going to get worse. And as the world gets smaller with communication and, you know, we travel more and we can do all these things, I think we're going to be exposed to just more of it. So I think it's important that we start to get out in front of it and talk about it. And it, like, people were asking me all the time, they're like, oh, what do you think these bands really do? Or what do you think this is? I don't give a shit. Because to me, if it gets you thinking about it just a little bit, you know, for the guy who buys a firearm, and my goal is to get this flyer into every firearm box made in the United States or outside of the United States that comes into the United States within the next 2 years. But if it makes one person slow down and think just for 1 second, then it's worth it. Or maybe a person opens that box and says, you know, I don't have an issue, but I have a friend who does. So I'm just going to give him this card because this is kind of interesting. You know, like that's what's important. So everything I'm doing is either to raise awareness or get someone to think about something. And I think it's important for us to be there when people are trying to make decisions on this stuff. I was just in Washington, D.C. I went to a mental health event. That was Friday. And on Saturday, I was at a firearms event. But I want to be at both. And I want to be able to tell people, you know, the reason why I'm here is because I want to make sure you don't make a mistake or you don't go off thinking something else. So when I was with the mental health community, it was great because I got to give them a perspective, because a lot of them, they're trying to understand. They're trying to understand why, when I throw statistics at somebody who's prior for my cold dead hands guy, why won't they listen? And I tell them the truth. I'll tell you why they don't listen. Your statistics don't mean anything. You know, you got to make them think. You got to make people think. And just like we have to with the other side, don't let me get going. But you know, it's one of those things, though. Like, we're going to learn and they're going to learn. You know what I mean? And we don't need legislation and we don't need these things, but we need to be able to start within ourselves. I think that's the most important thing. If it's one thing I want people to leave with in this conversation, is we have to start, like the drunk driving thing with the alcohol industry. Let's get out in front of it. You know what I mean? Let's give solutions. So people say, well, they don't care. Well, bullshit, you know?
Right. So, well, I think a lot of it also is in we have to police our own. And like you said, none of us want legislation. None of us want the government to tell us when we have to give up our rights and confiscate our weapons. So what's the alternative? Is we have to be able to show that as a community, we can police our own and be responsible gun owners. And part of being responsible gun owners is knowing when we shouldn't have firearms in our possession. And that's a big step. Or being able to confront a family or friend when you know that they probably shouldn't have firearms in their possession to protect themselves and others. We should be able to do that ourselves without Big Brother telling us to do that. So I think it's phenomenal what you're doing. David, thank you so, so much for coming and telling your story. It's been surreal. I mean, I've gone through all the emotions that one can go through. Listen to your story. Parts of it are hilarious, just the mental picture. But it's tragic to think that this was a very successful man who had everything in life was perfect until a crazy accident. And how not just his life, but entire families and friends and everyone that knows him, their lives have been turned upside down. And thank you for having the strength and the courage in you and your family to do something about it, because I know that was a hard decision. And, you know, firearms aside, who really cares at this point? This is life. But having that courage to sit there and say something's wrong and he needs help, and I hope to God that he gets the help he needs and everything works out in the end.
Yeah, man, I really appreciate you giving me the platform. And, you know, but I obviously got to thank Mike for, you know, just the last couple months being there for, you know, give me somebody to talk to about all this shit and, you know, advice, whatever. But, you know, Walk the Talk America is the thing, man. I mean, that's where the future of mental health and guns is Walk the Talk America.
Guys, if you're wanting to go get more information, obviously WTTA.org, make sure you go and check them out and check them out on all the social media. They're doing some great things. Guys, thank you for listening to the podcast. I really do appreciate it. You have been listening to the Armed Citizen Podcast. Semper Fi.
Thanks for listening to the Armed Citizen Podcast. To check out our full lineup of pro-gun media content, including our product reviews, live shows, and other Second Amendment activity, please check out our website, www.ghosttacticalproductions.com.